Welcome to East Meets West with me, Olga Bataman.
And me, Tara. How are you? And it's been so much news. It hasn't been since last time we were together.
Yeah, since our first episode,
yeah.
Right?
And you've had some adventures.
Well, I spent last week in Geneva that was hosting simultaneously two rounds of talks on the issue of Ukraine and on Iran. Mm-hmm. So I still have a bit of a blocked nose because of standing under the rain. But I have to say it's really worth it, mm-hmm. being, you know, where the history is written.
Right.
So, but let's discuss our assessments with our guests that have already joined us. Because that would be really interesting to compare our assessments from literally mm-hmm. across the ocean.
Oh, yeah, that's great. And we do have some great guests with us. We have George Papadopoulos, who was the former advisor on foreign affairs to Trump in 2016. And he's an author. He's also now a contributor at OANN with his own show as well. And Simona Mangente, his wife from Italy. She's an Italian lawyer, also American. And she also advised with the UN and has quite an eventful life herself and has been in documentaries as a host as well. So welcome to both of you. It's so great to see you.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Hi, Simona. Hi, George. So happy to see you with us.
Yeah.
So, George, may I ask you straight away, because I also was in Geneva. I was witnessing these talks on Ukraine happening there in the Hotel Intercontinental. What's your opinion? What's your assessment of the result of that round of talks that took place in Geneva last week?
Yeah, I mean, the president and his team have a lot on their table. They're trying to end and prevent wars that in many ways were instigated by previous administrations, including the Biden and the Obama administration. You can argue that the Obama administration's faulty foreign policy created the scenario that we now have with Iran. And of course, the Obama administration and the Biden administration regarding Ukraine. So what the president and his team are trying to do here is to clean up the mess, as they say in the United States. And I think the president campaigned on, and he won on, ending the war between Russia and Ukraine. And this is a very serious priority for the president, not only at a personal level, but of course, at the national and global level. And I think the official narrative now is that the Zelensky regime, I call it a regime, is very corrupt, that they're basically siphoning off millions and millions, potentially billions of dollars and potentially euros from both American and European taxpayers, because we can't forget that the Europeans have also, unfortunately, sent over 100 billion euros to this conflict. And the result has basically been bloodshed, territory lost, and a Ukraine that will never resemble what it did before the war. So the president has now decided that in order to stop the killing, in order to stop sending money and weapons, that there will be pressure on Zelensky. I was recently discussing this with the former White House chief strategist, Steve Bannon, the day that the Geneva talks began. And the president himself said that Zelensky better come to the table. He better make a deal. This came directly from President Trump's mouth.
And he was saying, like, I'm telling you, which is a very strong phrasing, I would say.
That's exactly what he said. He said this on Air Force One when asked by a U.S. journalist. And so it shows that the patience has now run very thin regarding Zelensky. So it's going to be very interesting to see what type of concessions that Zelensky now makes, because ultimately he will have to make concessions, whether they're on territory, whether it results in a referendum in Ukraine or ultimately an election. I think all three of these things will happen over the next 2 to 3 months.
That's what I would definitely agree with you upon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since I was there and we saw, you know, those European representatives of European states, and there was Starmer's security advisor, Jonathan Powell, who was there sitting in the lobby. I mean, they were not a part of the negotiations, but they were definitely like there. They were waiting for some sorts of the consultations. And I mean, we could feel it in the air that they're really like panicking. and they are scared of being left aside, you know, of the result of the negotiations, of any agreement to be made. So, and what we heard just the other day, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service revealed just the other day that France and United Kingdom are considering secret transfer of some components for nuclear weapons to Ukraine. Of course, these countries don't confirm it, but what do you think of this move? Does it show like the way, the level of the panic in European countries?
And Simona, you're from Italy, so if you could weigh in on this too. Yeah.
Well, Tara, that's really, I'm not surprised to know that European representatives were shaking. They actually been imploding under the weight of their own sanctions to Russia. So they have been struggling with a really falling economy for the last 4 years at the least. And there is, of course, a desperate attempt to kind of legitimize the decision, the wrong decision they made from the outset, by reinforcing the support to Ukraine. Now, this is one of the aspects of the unconditional support to Ukraine. There is also the corruption on the other side. There are many financial interests in this war that have been pushed forward by many European leaders, and I know right now I'm probably offending many, but this is an obvious situation that doesn't make European citizens happy, doesn't make Italians happy. You mentioned Italy in particular. You know that our relation to Russia had been nothing but friendly. Russia has always been a great partner of Italy. And on the general level, people struggle to understand this shift that has been caused by following Joe Biden's diktats back during his administration.
Yeah, you know, and Simona, you and George were both really targeted by the deep state and by the Democrats, the elite Dems. And there's been, you know, George even wrote a book about it. And luckily, Donald Trump pardoned you. And Simona, this story just was so compelling to me. You were brought up by Adam Rich to testify in Congress and being accused of being a Russian asset back in 2020, I believe. And this was the same week that Maria Butina was sentenced. They called it Russian Spy Week. Could you talk a little bit about that and how things have changed now under the Trump administration?
Tara, thanks for this question. I'd like to bring your audience back to the American theater of fake spies. Yeah. Well, definitely this week was particularly intense. I remember walking into Congress with all these cameras. You can Google my name and find the headlines of me being grilled by Congress the same week as Maria Butina with absolutely insanely outrageous questions. And none of them, of course, grounded in nothing. Everything was plain perception. They wanted to build up this character of a Russian spy attached to Donald Trump, a foreign policy advisor, which of course collapsed under their own lies. But, you know, living this experience was a bit of surreal, you know, reading a character displaying on the headlines right in front of you and trying to rewrite my origins, my background. Of course, nobody even bothered to say that I was fresh out of the European Union as an Italian legal advisor to the presidency office at the time. This was obviously absolutely dismissed as an information. I was simply portrayed as this individual, and you know, they said that I have a Russian accent. I don't know if I do. Definitely, we have a similar way to pronounce R, you know, these kind of things. You know, we have a kind of tough way of pronouncing words. They might not be familiar with traveling and worldviews. So that was very easy to simplify this character and try to make it fit a narrative. But that shows they don't care about human lives. They don't care about destroying the reputations. They're reckless. And I always believe that character assassination and false narrative should be severely punished, because when you destroy someone's reputation, you're destroying the very essence of this person. And this, I still feel they owe me an apology that never arrived. Besides, of course, everybody now agrees I was never involved in anything, but they never apologized to me. And nobody wrote headlines after that, to simply say, you were kind of the victim of this incredible script that was supposed to make Donald Trump look bad through George Papadopoulos. Mm-hmm.
If I may ask you about the situation with the Epstein files unfolding, because recently, if you remember, Prince Andrew was just all over the news, and just the other day, Thorbjørn Jagland either committed a suicide or they prevented him from committing a suicide. But like European leaders are like in the main focus, and the consequences are getting worse and worse. Does it also show this split happening between the United States and European states? How do you see that?
Well, I think Europeans have mastered the art of selectively highlight the information they are convenient to them. And there is absolutely a scandalous silence toward this criminal conduct. And I am one of those who firmly believes that Epstein didn't commit suicide. I think he was killed. And there are the same reason to kill people involved with Epstein. Because, you know, it's a domino that will lead to the fallout of many other corrupt characters.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the timing, George, if I may ask you?
Yeah, I think certainly that there's a major divide between the U.S. and many European elites. I wouldn't say the countries, but certainly the elites have tried to transform numerous European countries. You had Marco Rubio and others talk, and J.D. Vance have talked about the civilizational collapse of Europe. And what the Epstein files have really showed is that there is a corrupt elite that has been running many of these countries, from countries in Sweden, Norway. You've had, you know, the son of some of these aristocrats arrested recently, obviously Prince Andrew. So I'm not surprised that once the files were declassified, and now that these files have been given to the prosecutor's office in numerous countries, that we have had arrests in Europe. But people in America are waiting for the arrests for the people that were involved in crimes. So that's something that we'll have to wait to see if it really does happen or not.
Yeah, you know, there's 3 million files that still haven't even been released. So they were supposed to release all of them, they haven't. I wanted to kind of come back around to the release of the Epstein files, but a bigger release, too, in my mind, that Tulsi Gabbard, and George, you and I both know Tulsi, and maybe Simona as you as well, she released that Russiagate was a fake. It was a hoax. It was a conspired artificial thing that happened between the Obamas and the Clintons. And it's criminally illegal. It's illegal in the United States what happened. Yet there hasn't been an indictment yet. There's investigations. So, George, could you speak a little bit about kind of the timing of the Epstein files and how it kind of overshadowed the Russiagate and that investigation and maybe some thoughts you have?
Yeah, I mean, So the Russiagate or Obamagate, like I want to make it very clear, was never an investigation, it was an operation. It was an operation that was hatched by both U.S. and foreign intelligence services involving NATO countries like Italy, the United Kingdom, some other countries in Europe. It had nothing to do with Russia. So Russia was basically framed, and the way that I was framed and President Trump was framed, in order to instigate what I think was an inevitable conflict that the deep state and the Democrats wanted with Russia. And that's really why I think that was the pretext to what they were ultimately always trying to do with Ukraine and Russia. So just want to make that very clear. There is an ongoing criminal investigation. There have been now 5 investigations into this story, which is unprecedented. And I think we will finally have real answers about the truth regarding how the Obama administration attempted to destabilize the Trump administration. We've never had a former president try to stop the smooth transition of power between his successor. And that's really what the lesson of this story is. And by doing so, they destroyed the reputation of the FBI, the CIA, the intelligence services, domestically, the rule of law, and how the United States has diplomatic relations with foreign governments. It obviously has affected the sanctions situation with Russia. This is something that many people don't understand or even know about, but what happened during this situation affected how the U.S. Relationship with Russia is. So all of this major scandal was discussed this past summer by Tulsi Gabbard and President Trump, where they called it a treasonous conspiracy. But now, with the release of the Epstein files, I don't call it a distraction. I think it's actually part of the method to show the American people that this type of corruption does exist, so that it will, once the prosecutions do occur at the very highest levels of the Obama administration, people in America and around the world will, I guess, be ready for it. While before, this might have been too extravagant or too extraordinary to even consider that somebody like a President Obama or a James Comey or a John Brennan or somebody else could be under prosecution.
George, if I may ask you a very straightforward question. Isn't Trump scared that there's something about him in the Epstein files? Because I know his name is also mentioned there a number of times. Isn't he scared of that? Didn't he have anything to do with that?
No, I wholeheartedly believe he had nothing to do with mm-hmm. Epstein. In fact, there are reports that he reported Epstein to the FBI. He kicked him out of Mar-a-Lago, which is his private residence and the club that many, you know, renowned people have been members of for decades. And I always say there were the people that knew Epstein before the crimes, there were people that knew him during the crimes, and people that knew him both before and after the crime. And President Trump is a person that knew him before all of that, and he distanced himself from him. And also, by releasing these files, a person that's implicated with crimes would not release files or millions and millions of files. And I've been saying it recently, while the Democrats thought that this would be a bad thing for Trump, ultimately it's implicated the highest Democrats, people like Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, lawyers from the Obama administration, many other people, Prince Andrew, all of these leftists and globalists around the world. They're the ones who have been arrested, including the former UK ambassador to the United States, Mandelson, who was just arrested. So it's a very strange and funny situation, I guess, that the Democrats thought this would take down Trump, but it's ultimately taking them down.
That's a good point.
Let's move to Iran, since we skipped that round of negotiations. So if we can move gears a little bit to Iran. The situation is really unfolding in front of our eyes, so to say. Tucker Carlson, from what we know, even talked to Trump,
mm-hmm.
To persuade him, to make him change his mind. And yesterday there was the State of Union address of President Trump. Mm-hmm. We see he's building up serious military presence of the United States in the Persian Gulf. And we, of course, know that Israeli lobby is putting its pressure on him. But on the other hand, from what I know, like 70, maybe up to 80% of Americans, they don't support the invasion from what we've heard. Okay. So if Trump cares about America first, I mean, he shouldn't invade Iran. So what do you think? Where is he now? Whether it's going to happen, or is he like listening that much to Israeli lobby and not to his own people?
Yeah, what we're hearing is that basically Trump is listening to the hawks like Lindsey Graham, but he's not listening to the two people, Vance and Tulsi Gabbard, are two people that I've heard that are against this war. However, the Joint Chiefs of Staff that he appointed are all for this invasion of Iran, and they're using the same arguments. Oh, they're just about to have nuclear weapons. They're a week away. They've been saying that for 10 years, George and Simona, right? So what are your opinions, like each of you, if you could answer this?
And just sorry for jumping up, but I mean, this topic. So the Iranian nuclear program is unprecedentedly transparent, as we all know. I mean, not a single country was observed in the way that Iran was, and the country was bombed not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how can there be anything left of Iranian nuclear program, you know, to start another invasion?
Well, Tara and Olga, I believe that Trump is using this placement of, I agree with you, heavy military resources in the Middle East that is unprecedented since the war in Iraq, just as a rhetoric for negotiable leverage. Now, when we come to the Iran nuclear agreement, I agree with you that this has been transparently clear, and even United States agreed to the civil development of nuclear weapons. But we're talking about the legal question is, can we preventively neutralize a nuclear threat that could eventually overpass these limits, or this is just a negotiable strategy? I believe there is a negotiable strategy from Donald Trump, because ultimately, I agree with you, this would be counterproductive, even for the midterms election, and for the satisfaction of the entire American electorate with his policies. Nobody's interested in the further wars abroad. Ultimately, nobody believes that a targeted attack to the nuclear sites or a general attack to overthrow the regime is in the American interest in any way. So I believe it won't attack, but that's my personal opinion. Even because it's legally challenging to justify such an attack with a preventive nuclear neutralization, which honestly wouldn't make much sense right now.
Would a poop boat play any role in that? Because as we know, like the most expensive American ship is flooded with the excrements of its own crew.
Feces, yeah. So. Apparently the toilets broke. So I posted something that who knew World War III would be avoided by a broken toilet. So, but that aside, George, I wanted your thoughts on who's got Trump's ear. What do you think? On some of the things we brought up?
You know, I've been on this MAGA movement since 2015, when people didn't believe in it or understood what Trump was all about. I kind of really understood psychologically, I guess. That's why, I left a very important job in Washington, D.C. to join him, because I understood that he had a real knack for understanding situations that others didn't. And when you ask who has his ear, I think he has his own ear. And I don't say that loosely. I really believe that he has a vision for what the world should look like, what America's role should look like, and what the limits of American power are, and prioritizing geoeconomics over geopolitics. So you have to remember what he campaigned against, and that was the neoconservative movement, the George W. Bush movement, and he destroyed the Bush legacy. The last thing he wants to do as a successful negotiator, ex-businessman, and I believe a historic president, is to go back in time and to restart the clock on the failed military interventions, sucking America into these interventions at a time when Iran is not Afghanistan or Iraq of 2003. Let's just be very realistic. Iran is a country of over 80 million people. It has extremely close ties now with China. You can argue even with Russia. It's a sophisticated technological country with a burgeoning nuclear peaceful, if you want to call it, program. It's not isolated the way that people believe it is. In fact, it trades with Turkey, which is the second largest NATO country. And I've recently been talking about all these variables that people seem to forget. People like Ted Cruz and some of these others, who I don't really respect or think are intelligent. They don't even know what the demographic of Iran is. They don't know how many people live there. They don't understand what's at stake. And the last thing I'll say is many Arab countries, including the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, have pledged trillions of dollars in FDI to the U.S. economy. Where are those countries situated? They are situated adjacent to a potential conflict zone, in which Iran, if they are in a desperate position, if they feel that their regime or their government is ultimately about to fall, they will have no other recourse except to strike American bases and allied bases around the Middle East, and that could affect the future of the U.S. economy as well. So when you look at all of this in its totality, I agree completely with Simona that I think that this military hardware buildup is a negotiation tactic. I don't think it is in the interest of anybody in the Middle East, including not that Russia's in the Middle East, but Russia as well, for Iran to have a nuclear power, and that there will ultimately be some sort of negotiation that will prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon without the U.S. intervening militarily. I really see that happening, and I think the next 2 days in Geneva will prove me right. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you go ahead.
I just since we're talking about ears and who is listening to whom, it would like wrap it up to what we started with.
Right.
These European leaders that we see Trump is really pushing forward the negotiation process, right? So he's really pushing on the agreement to be reached, while the European leaders are kind of trying to torpedo the talks, you know, they're trying to do everything possible, you know, to avoid the agreement to be reached. So, and those are heads of states.
Right.
So they're definitely not acting in the interests of their own peoples. So whom are they listening to if they're not listening to Trump, obviously?
Right.
I think they're listening to their state perception of self-interest. There is nothing such as a European Union voice as one. As we already know, one thing America has done is to expose the weakness and fragmentation of a union that lacks an army, lacks a constitution, so it can't be a credible interlocutor on the global stage. When we talk about a multipolar world, we just see the rising power of Russia, China, and the United States, but the European Union doesn't exist in this new geopolitical scenario. Right. So I think there, Olga, you said it right, that all they can do is to sabotage for the sake of sabotaging the reachment of agreements. And sometimes this comes from lack of vision. And when you don't understand yourself, what you are, when you stand, it's very difficult to reach an agreement because they don't know what to bring to the table and what they want from the same table.
It's the lack of identity and the lack of national interest, which is the basics of any geopolitics, right?
Yeah, exactly. And one final question to both of you. Now we're entering peace talks. They're going to involve Iran, but we also are entering the peace talks regarding Ukraine. What is your vision about when the U.S. stops sending aid to Ukraine, which they've pretty much stopped, but like, when will all of that cease and they'll stop the support of Zelensky and this wraps up into peace? What is your thoughts, especially with this new information that France and the U.K. are secretly going to give nuclear power to Kiev. So what would Trump have to say about that? And what are your thoughts? George, we'll start with you, and then if we could finish up with Simona.
I think we have to look at the next 75 years of this century to understand how the United States is positioning itself in its relations to Russia and Eastern Europe, Ukraine, NATO. I think a lot of what the Greenland issue, the renegotiating of trade with Canada and Mexico, and obviously overthrowing Maduro had to do with is the concept of sphere of influence. I think we are going back to the concept of spheres of influence. I think great powers will have a lot more leverage and influence in their own backyards without other governments or foreign powers intervening. I think that is why this negotiation now with Ukraine and Russia is very important, because if the U.S. is expecting Russia and China not to be in Venezuela or Cuba, then Russia should obviously expect NATO and the United States and the CIA not to interfere in Ukraine or other countries in Central Asia or in the Caucasus, as they've done historically. So given this situation, and of course, the U.S. having a massive interest in China and Russia not closely aligning too much, this has been U.S. foreign policy since the days of Nixon. I think that the situation with Ukraine now is viewed as an impediment to U.S. foreign policy instead of a function of U.S. foreign policy. And that's why in order for the United States to have relations with Russia in terms of oil and gas developments, AI, R&D, space, potentially military collaboration, which I could see in the future, they have to drop support for Zelensky. And that's why I also think all of these stories about corruption in Ukraine are coming out over the last couple months. It's painting a different narrative about what Ukraine really is. For years, the mainstream media in the United States painted Ukraine as this democracy, as Zelensky fighting evil, this bizarre fake story. Well, now the narrative is completely changed. The narrative now is that Zelensky's corrupt, that the French and the British are trying to suck American military men into this conflict, that the United States has no reason to do so. And the United States, more importantly, is losing business and trade and its own security by not having relations with Russia. So that's why it's so important for these facts to come out and for people to articulate them like you are on your show and have been done recently, because that's really what the Trump administration and I think the United States is moving towards, not only for today, but how the U.S.-Russia relationship will look like through the next 75 years of this entire century.
Yes, I couldn't agree more with George's take. I would just add that from the last years, from the Democrat side, we have seen treating Russia as the enemy, while the current administration is looking at Russia as a potential partner again. So that's the key distinction between what we have seen before and the shift we're assisting to now. Mm-hmm. How this translates into interrupting and withdrawing support to Zelensky, it translates in Trump's own words, better you find an agreement or don't count on us. If European Union MIOP leaders want to help Ukraine, go ahead. I mean, we won't come and save you again. So I think that's a huge shift. And it's a powerful shift, and Russia is not the demon anymore, is the partner we would like as an ally.
That I think is exactly correct. Russia as a partner,
not as an enemy.
Not an enemy, and Ukraine being formerly a function of US foreign policy to now being an impediment of US foreign policy. And I think that has been the 180 shift from the Biden-Obama administration to the Trump administration, and why we finally do have the potential to open this new chapter, which we wholeheartedly support. I know, of course, President Putin and President Trump support, and I think it'll be for the betterment of the world and, of course, the Russian and American people.
And also we can treat a country and a nation as a partner and then accepting NATO bases at its borders. So this is a core part of the negotiation that must be understood by both, the NATO members and many European member states.
On that note, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for such a great conversation.
Yeah, this
we
was
managed
great.
To squeeze everything in half an hour, most of the events that happened throughout the week.
Yes. So thank you for your time. And let's hope for world peace.
Of course. We hope we'll discuss a great results soon with you. Thanks so much for the invitation. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Thank you,
Thank
Simona.
You. Thank you. Well, that's all we have time for today on East Meets West. But please follow us on social media. And you can find us on X, on Rumble now, on also in Russian media. So,
on YouTube in Russian, on YouTube in English. So all sorts of platforms. And please write in comments your suggestions of the guests, of the questions that maybe you want to ask but don't dare to. We'll do it for you, as you see, in our straightforward manner. So we'll see you soon on East Meets West.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Baka baka.